Hey guys, I'm Michaela.
I'm Amy.
And this is the Poetry Slam. Now we're moving into the Victorian era this week on the show, so get ready for a good old double bill of misogyny and murder.
We'll talk about how important these two things are later, but now let's talk about Browning.
We're going to be talking about something I'm sure 90% of listeners have experienced before, that weird sudden desire to do the complete opposite of what you should. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, I get it. Like swerving into an oncoming car, pushing someone onto the train tracks, robbery, murder?
Whether you want to admit it or not, everyone's brain does it, and there's a word for it.
Really? So that feeling's normal?
Sure is. Apparently it's a sign of a functioning psychological system. The fact we're shocked by those kind of thoughts actually makes us up to 60% less likely to commit a crime.
Heck, well, I guess you won't see me with a gun in my hand anytime soon. What's it called?
An imp. It seems like this exact feeling was a huge influence on a lot of Browning's work. What starts to sound like a sweet, airy-fairy poem when you start reading often suddenly and violently descends into, well, murder. It almost feels like Browning works out a lot of emotion in his words, creating these twisted characters that could be your Victorian-era next-door-neighbour sort of folk. Browning's fascination with those sociopathic and psychopathic perspective was really what led him to his poetic fame. His fascination with poetry started very early, driven by his well-educated father. His first successful piece of work was written in 1833, age 21, and that was when he really birthed the idea of the dramatic monologue. This idea flowed into pretty much all of the rest of his popular work, including all the pieces we're going to talk about today. So, without further ado...
So we've already briefly mentioned the dramatic monologue, but what are they exactly?
This technique uses one speaker throughout the poem, and in Browning's case, fleshes out the writing by setting the scene and telling the story all through the perspective of one narrator. This perspective often manages to give us a rather intimate look inside the speaker's head, and inside the heads of Browning's speakers, well, there's some interesting stuff going on.
This poem we're looking at was published in 1836, and it's titled Porphyria's Lover. I mean, it's quite a dark piece of writing at first glance, despite its airy-fairy name, and reading it feels like a secretive glimpse into the life of a quiet sociopath. Spooky.
What begins as a sweet depiction of a stormy night and an alluring woman eventually falls down the rabbit hole of lust, possession, and murder. Sounds a bit spicier now, doesn't it, Amy?
Sure does. Even from the beginning, there's this sense of mystery. Browning consistently uses complex imagery in his writings, and this poem is no exception.
The rain set in early tonight, the sullen wind was soon awake. It tore the elm tops down for spite and did its worst to vex the late. There's this immediate use of pathos, using the weather to really bring an uneasiness to the reader, almost foreshadowing that this cautionary tale was going to end badly.
And then we have our lead for the poem walk in, or should I say glided in. She already appears angelic, and this suggested sensuality.
This feel definitely continues as the story progresses, doesn't it? She proceeds to light the fire, shut up the cabin from the storm. It's not even until she takes off her dripping cloak and soiled gloves that she even greets our speaker. At last, she sat down by my side.
Oof, that's a bit of neglect right there. You can really feel the tension between these two, huh? Maybe there was an unresolved argument, perhaps?
As the narrative goes on, there's this recurring motive of control, and what really challenges the context at the time is that the control doesn't go to who you'd expect.
Well, who does it go to?
Think about it. Porphyria enters the cottage without a word to the narrator, lights the fire, sits down beside him, and then she moves his arm around her like manipulating a doll. It appears later that Porphyria has just come home from a feast of sorts, so there's even the inference that she may have had more of a significant social standing than him. It is clear that for a good three quarters of this poem, we, the audience, should be under the understanding that Porphyria is in control of the situation.
That really defies Victorian stereotypes too. From the second she enters the cottage, the statement of her almost obtrusive sexuality lets us know that Porphyria here is no ordinary woman. Even her name disrupts the flow of the writing. What should be a consistent iambic tetrameter poem has an A-B-A-B-B rhyme scheme. It's asymmetrical and gives a sort of rushed jumble feel to the meter.
Porphyria's name doesn't fit into any of the lines it appears in either. Does this mean the narrator can't really fit her into his life either?
Well, that's rather ominous.
Just you wait, it gets worse. We hit this line, I decided what to do, and with five words, the speaker lets us know that Porphyria is not in charge anymore. His next move is his decision, and she is under his authority. To add to this control, there's these next couple of lines. That moment she was mine, mine fair. Here's this theme of possession that we will explore later on in the episode. The possessive mine pronoun, the repetition.
Like in My Last Duchess, right?
Shh, we're not up to that yet.
All right. So where does the poem actually start to go downhill then?
Three times her little throat around and strangled her. Is that downhill enough for you?
Oh my god. So basically, this guy is just sitting in his cottage. His lover glides on in, shows her love for him, and then he strangles her without a word? Sociopath much?
It goes further than that, however. He even goes as far to prop her body up against him, open her eyes and sit there with her corpse beside him, reassuring himself that since God has not said a word, all of this must be okay, right?
It's one of those poems where you read it the first time and don't actually realise what's going on until you pause and read it again. It descends so rapidly into this shock factor that honestly, it's easy to think you've misread something.
But this is what Browning does, you see. He starts off with a gentle poem that allows you to see snippets of a character's personality and then rips off the curtain at the end for you to actually realise what you're looking at. We start the poem under the impression of little things. There might be tension between them. He seems annoyed. She seems adoring. But then you jump down a couple of stanzas and realise what we're dealing with here is in fact a controlling and possessive lover that wants to preserve a perfect moment like a painting using death as the artist.
What the heck? That's whack. There's a lot of questions and interpretations of this poem too. I mean, did she want to die? Was she ill? Was he ill? He never said a word after all, and some people read from this text that our main guy may have been mute.
I think anyone who reads this poem should really consider the interpretation aspect. It makes you think, what do you reckon really happened?
It's a shame that we can never really know what Browning's intention was with the poem, but that really says a lot about his writings. He really has that writing skill of playing mind games with his readers. His exploration of the human psyche is actually pretty fascinating.
Are you done nerding out yet? Now we've looked at the actual content of the poem, how does this relate to the rest of Browning's work? Well, reading through Porphyria's Lover, there's this obtrusive female sexuality that we brushed over earlier, which really makes a move to fight the traditional feel of the Victorian era. See, this time between 1837 and 1901 was really known for its treatment of women. The common lady was treated more like a commodity than a companion, and men would show them off like pieces of jewellery.
It's really different from what we see in this poem, which is a woman who attempts to take control of the situation by being the one who initiates a lot of the interactions here. In a time where this Porphyria character would really have no rights or respect given to her at all, it's even controversial that she was the one who was outside the cabin. She had been out, and without a man presumably. She has what not many women of the time had, autonomy.
This really makes it all the sadder that this was taken away from her when she was strangled. It's similar to another of Browning's works that we'll be talking about, another control-focused monologue called My Last Duchess.
If you were looking for a poem that openly objectifies and dehumanizes women, you've come to the right place here, haven't you? What do you think about this one?
Look, I think even reading the title of this poem, you get an idea of what kind of relationship we're talking about here. The use of my, it kind of irks me.
I totally agree. There's this possessive pronoun again, like we saw towards the end of Porphyria's Lover, with the mine. And it definitely does feel like we have a bit of a theme to hold on to here.
Definitely, and you can see the theme throughout this one quite clearly. For anyone who hasn't read this one yet, let me give you a summary. Basically, this old Duke of Ferrara, very prestigious of course, is describing this painting of his last duchess, his wife. We later find out that he has this growing jealousy of her being so happy all the time, and about three quarters of the way through the poem, we discover that he even kills her because of it. Then, to wrap it all up, this is all in conversation to one of the messengers from the family of the next duchess that he is yet to marry.
Guy sure moves on quick, doesn't he?
Sure does. This Duke is an interesting character, and like in Porphyria's Lover, you really get a broad idea of his character by the end of the poem. You move past the title into the lines, and once more there's this use of my last duchess. Fra Pandolf's hands work busily a day. Even that line sounds like further objectification. It's only Fra Pandolf's hands that are mentioned, not Fra Pandolf as a person.
This guy definitely sits on sort of a high horse here, doesn't he? Let's have a look at the rhyme scheme and the meter here too, because it sure says a lot about his character.
You're right, Amy. My Last Duchess is written in symmetrical iambic pentameter, designed to be read in the orderly AABBCC meter. This style of wording is one of the closest to natural human conversation, so I know that this Duke is speaking quite relaxedly and conversationally throughout the poem. There's even enjambment, with the words and ideas continuing to flow down the page.
He's obviously a very structural and stern kind of person then, isn't he?
Absolutely. The language he uses throughout the monologue is quite stern and controlling, and he loves to show off his 900-year-old name. Even the use of Durst early on lets us know that he's pretty explicit that he has a lot of power in his position. He's literally daring someone to ask him about his last duchess.
All these things combined is what really brings out the controlling themes of this work and really link it to the need for possession and power themes that we see in Porphyria's Lover.
I think what most people don't see when reading these poems, however, is the influence that women have on the narrator. See, there's this really obvious statement of male domination in them both. They're the ones that kill them both in the end after all. But what's easy to miss is this pull that both Porphyria and the Duchess have. It's this allurement of female sexuality that we're going to dive into next.
You know what? Women literally deserve to have much a say in these poems as the men do.
Think about it. We talked earlier about how Porphyria took control when she entered into the cottage, but we didn't discuss her behaviour with her lover. There's a full scene where she mumbles her love for him, exposes her shoulder, plays with her hair. There's this aspect of sexuality and power about her. Any reader can interpret that kind of body language pretty easily. Even after she dies, her lover is literally so obsessed with her that she keeps her body beside him, capturing a perfect moment. Well, perfect for him at least.
Exactly, and it's not only Porphyria that appears to entrance her lover even after she's well and truly dead. In My Last Duchess, the Duke is talking about a painting of his dead wife, and for a really long time too. It's assumed that this painting is in a pretty prominent spot as well, either in a private gallery or in a bedroom. He'd be looking at it a lot.
Yeah, and despite the fact that it appears through the writing that the Duke finds more appeal in the painting than his actual alive previous wife, it's clear that she still has some kind of grip on him.
Maybe the Duke really was just jealous of how happy his late wife seemed. See, in Browning's poems, murder doesn't actually mean there wasn't love there. It was clear that the lover had feelings for Porphyria, and the Duke probably wouldn't have had such a large painting of the Duchess if he didn't love her either. He didn't necessarily kill her because of hate or anger, it was more jealousy.
It's almost as if the Duke just wanted the Duchess all to himself. He even put curtains up so that he could be the one controlling who looked at her and when. He didn't want her smiling at anything else but him, so in his own words, he gave commands and then all smiles stopped altogether.
I mean, the jealousy is kind of sweet, but in a twisted, terrible way, hey?
Exactly, and there it is again, Browning making these disturbed characters with such two-edged swords. It's hard to pick who's in the right, who's in the wrong. Once again, it's interpretation. There's no way to tell the absolute truth.
Now that we're talking about jealousy, how about we introduce our third poem, The Laboratory?
Alrighty-o, I've got a challenge for you. Read this name for me.
Marie Madeleine Margaret d'Aubray, Marquise de Brunvilly.
Nice try. The name is of the woman who pretty much inspired this poem. She was actually born way before Browning's life, too, in 1676. But hey, this guy takes inspiration from a lot of places. His era, his wife, his history. So anyway, this Marie lady was a murdering French aristocrat who would poison her family members. She even tried to kill her husband. And why? Jealousy and power, of course.
Seems like we have a bit of a theme here, don't we now?
Sure do. See, in this poem, The Laboratory, a young lady discovers that her lover is cheating on her with another woman, and so she does what any level-headed, cheated-on person would do. She goes to the local apothecary to find the perfect concoction to leave her new mistress dead.
Very level-headed indeed. Reading through this, I have to admit, I love the jealousy and anger that seethes through the words. It's a very passionate poem, using very passionate language, like the rest of Browning's work.
Yep, and like the rest of Browning's work, he also uses the rhyme and meter to effectively communicate the voice of the speaker. This one is an anapaestic tetrameter, with two short syllables followed by one long one. This leads to an AABB pattern and gives a sense of faltering control from the narrator. The poem mostly sticks to this pattern and then occasionally hiccups as the writing progresses, showing this building excitement about, well, murder.
I think what really gets you as well is, despite the cruel and twisted nature of the content of the poem, the writing appears so unnaturally calm and composed. We have a very stern, controlling and determined speaker. I mean, how does this link to Porphyria's Lover and My Last Duchess?
Well, looking at the themes, we have this jealousy again. He's with her and they know that I know. Where they are, what they do, they believe my tears flow. Reading it, you can really feel the emotion in her voice. There's anger, there's disgust, and there's definitely betrayal. Then, much like the other two poems, we have this obsession with control, like the Duke needing to kill the Duchess for control and the lover strangling Porphyria. Our speaker appears obsessed with the death of this person. Let death be felt and the proof remain. He is sure to remember her dying face.
That's pretty dark. I mean, but it is Browning after all. I think the main connections here are really just the insensitivity of murder, the drive behind it, and the darkness in which the speaker says her part. It comes together so well. Also, Robert is a talented writer, and you can really understand the dark messages of his work through the techniques he uses. The metaphors of carrying pure death, the alliteration of moisten and mash, and then pound up the paste. They all work together to create a really imaginative and imagery-full poem.
So these were our poems for today. Did you like them? Were you moved? Browning's work, whilst it may not be for everyone, definitely has a meaning to it. There's a message and a movement in everything he writes, and it's what makes his poetry so incredibly gripping to read.
Yeah, he certainly does well to explore the human psychology, bringing out the desires, dreams, and destructive tendencies of humanity.
You can't read his work without taking something from it.
And us as readers aren't the only ones who have taken things from his poetry. Poets across the world of the Victorian era all the way to the present have taken his work and made elements of it in their own. He's been an incredibly important influence to the English writing scene.
That's right. Apparently Browning had been said to have influenced Robert Frost, he's the guy with the diverging roads, and Ezra Pound. He really did leave a legacy.
And so there it is. The themes of control, jealousy, relationship, and power have stood the test of time when it comes to his poetry, and it's likely that they will continue to stand for decades still.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Poetry Slam, and we hope that you've gained a little bit of appreciation for the good old Victorian era.
See you guys next time!